This podcast is for general education, information, and entertainment purposes only, and is not to be used as medical advice for any particular patient. Clinicians must rely on their own informed clinical judgment in making recommendations to their patients. Furthermore, the views and statements expressed on this podcast are solely those of the hosts and should not be interpreted to reflect the official policies or positions of any entity. Hello and welcome to this week's episode of BCR Pod. I'm Michael Fishman.
And I'm Jamie Lim. We're both pediatric senior residents and your hosts for this podcast.
We're going to be taking the next 15 minutes or so to review a few of the case-based residency conferences from the past week, a few tilts or things I learned today from our clinical shifts, and then highlight co-residents doing cool stuff towards the end.
Fish, how do you feel now that we've officially sent out an email to the residency to let them know about our podcast, that we've gone BCRP public or BCR public?
I think people should start buying shares. We'll make an NFT.
This is an NFT, right? Okay. Anyway, with that, let's get started. Starting out with our conference recaps. Monday morning, we had a conference by our very own chief, Dr. Kelly McCullough. The case was about a three-month-old with fever, vomiting, increased fussiness, who re-presented to the ED for a second time with concerns for a seizure that required IM midazolam on route to the hospital. The baby was admitted to the floor where his twin brother had an episode also concerning for a seizure. Eventually, the baby was found to have GBS bacterial meningitis with a course complicated by multifocal brain infarcts and empyema. The takeaways that I got from this conference were first to know the common bugs of meningitis that change with age. At this patient's age, 1 to 3 months, the most common bugs include GBS, E. coli, Listeria, Strep, and Neisseria. Another interesting thing that I learned was that there are certain indications for steroids in bacterial meningitis, but it really depends on the organism, it depends on the timing, and it also depends on the empiric antibiotic regimen. Studies have shown that there is a confirmed benefit in cases of Hib meningitis if given 10 to 20 minutes prior to the first dose of antibiotics, although other data on benefits of steroids in pediatrics is currently lacking. The last thing I learned was that group B strep can occur at all sorts of different timelines. It's called early onset if it occurs within the first 24 hours of a baby's life, up to 6 days. It's considered late onset if it happens 7 to 89 days of life. And then it's considered late onset if it happens greater than 90 days of life. This late onset GBS is not prevented by interpartum antibiotics and is most often due to horizontal transmission from colonized caregivers or a sibling.
On Tuesday, we had a case conference by our own Dr. Colleen Kelly, who presented a very interesting case of a 23-year-old female with asthma, obesity, a history of multiple psych diagnoses, who presented with right-sided pleuritic chest pain and shortness of breath in the setting of having knee surgery 11 days prior, who was ultimately diagnosed with an acute pulmonary embolism. This case was really fascinating, less so for the pulmonary embolism management, but more for the fact that on day 4 of admission, the wards team was called to bedside for acute onset altered mental status. So a lot of great learning about altered mental status. And I think a few big takeaways for me were really the definition of altered mental status. It's a change in mental status, almost always acute. And it's not a diagnosis, but a group of variable, non-specific neurologic symptoms. So thinking how we describe it, just like we describe rashes, can be really important. So thinking of altered mental status on a spectrum, starting from one end of alert, somnolent, lethargic, obtunded, stuporous, unresponsive, coma. And so thinking how we go through. She also presented a few different algorithms or frameworks to think through altered mental status. One that I found helpful for me is the mnemonic MISTO, M-I-S-T-O. The M stands for metabolic toxic. So thinking about poisons, medications, but also electrolyte abnormalities and hyperammonemia. The I is for infection. The S is for stroke or seizure. The T is for trauma. And the O is for hypoxemia or hypercarbia. This patient was ultimately diagnosed with catatonia, which is its own very interesting kind of medical world, and improved with an Ativan challenge.
Tuesday's noon conference was given by Dr. Christina Briscoe-Bath, one of the pediatric neurology chief residents. Her presentation was on the basics of how to distinguish seizures. We first went over the technical definition of a seizure, which is abnormal, excessive, or synchronous discharges of neurons residing in the cerebral cortex. We also talked a little bit about a case of potential febrile seizures, where I learned that the age at which it happens is very, very important. We're classically taught that it happens within the timeline of 6 months to 6 years of age, but really a vast majority of these febrile seizures happen between 1 to 3 years of age. We are also taught that the risk of developing epilepsy is after a febrile seizure is higher than the general population, although it's still quite low. But I also learned that factors including features of complex febrile seizures actually increases that risk. For example, multiple seizures within a 24-hour period, focality, et cetera. I also actually kind of learned for the first time like what the technical definition of epilepsy is. Epilepsy is defined as either two unprovoked seizures occurring greater than 24 hours apart, one unprovoked seizure, and a probability of further seizures similar to the general recurrence risk, which is at least 60% after two unprovoked seizures occurring over the next 10 years, or if someone has a diagnosis of epilepsy syndrome, which is why I think a lot of people are starting to really distinguish between seizures and epilepsy, and why the terminology has shifted to the term ASM or anti-seizure medication, as opposed to AEM or anti-epilepsy medications. And then finally, just some practical tips when we're calling our neurologists because of a patient with concern for a seizure or some sort of episode, important tips are to ask the parent for a video if that was caught, describe what was happening before the event, then describe the event, which includes the onset, what the patient's tone looked like, what was happening with the eyes, what was happening with the patient's color, bowel, bladder, how long it lasted, if the episode or the shaking was a tremor or rhythmic or any sort of flailing activity, and finally describe what happened after the event.
Wednesday's noon conference was Dr. Bobby Rosen, who initially presented the case of a 16-year-old with hemoglobin SS who presented with bilateral knee pain and hypoxemia to the high 80s on room air that persisted despite 7 days of treatment for ACS. Hemoglobin that was lower than baseline. And the really important question was whether or not this is a patient that you should transfuse. And the teaching here is that patients with sickle cell disease or similar phenotypes, there's a lot of RBC alloimmunization in sickle cell disease, and there's a limited supply of extended match units to blood groups, the FY, JK, and SS units. Don't ask me more because I don't know what those stand for. But the important thing is transfusion is not always a benign and helpful thing, and thinking that with every transfusion, they're at higher risk of developing antibodies that might then make transfusions down the road more and more difficult and more dangerous. So being thoughtful about the risk and benefits with every unit that you transfuse. And also the equity lens that most of our blood donor pool is actually from people of European ancestry versus African ancestry, which just exacerbates risks for these antibodies. And the reason he presented this case was actually really well done in the sense that here's a case of, well, it seems like it's obvious to just transfuse this patient to help with their oxygen delivering capacity. But there was recently a case at Knott's Sub Hospital of a teenager with sickle cell disease who came in for a pain crisis after wisdom tooth extraction, had a transfusion at a previous admission about 1 week prior, but this time was presenting with fever, anemia, decreased reticulocyte count, high LDH, and low haptoglobin, all concerning for a hemolytic picture. Was ultimately diagnosed with the very rare delayed hemolytic transfusion reaction, which can occur within 21 days following transfusion, and presented in a hyperhemolytic state with a hemoglobin dropping from almost 10 to 2 in 2 days, and then being pretty much at every risk factor of critical profound anemia and poor delivery of oxygen. So again, just reinforcing our interventions are not always benign and being thoughtful about risks and benefits.
And then Thursday's noon conference was Approach to Weakness by Dr. Killian, who's one of the stroke and neurocritical care fellows. The important parts of history taking when approaching any patient with weakness includes the onset, progression, pattern, which includes either distal versus proximal, unilateral versus bilateral, ascending, descending, fixed, patchy, as well as associated symptoms, systemic symptoms, and also making sure that you know the patient's baseline function. The places where lesions could be for a patient with weakness includes the brain, obviously, or the spine, but it could be more specific, including the anterior horn, peripheral nerve, the neuromuscular junction, or the muscle itself. We went over a few cases, including Bell's palsy, where important considerations are whether or not the patient's actually having a stroke, Ramsey-Hunt syndrome, or if they have multiple cranial neuropathies, that's a little bit more concerning. I also went through a case of Guillain-Barré syndrome, where I learned that the required features include a progressive motor weakness of more than one limb and areflexia or marked hyporeflexia. The most common cause of death is autonomic dysfunction in these patients. So treatment is mostly supportive, but you can use IVIG and plasmapheresis to speed up recovery. And finally, we went over a case of an infant with botulism, where I learned that the earliest sign may be constipation, which is terrifying because I can't count the number of times that I've seen infants with constipation and never thought about botulism. But the treatment of botulism is immunoglobulin. Also very important to note that antibiotic therapy may acutely worsen symptoms as toxin is released into the intestinal lumen following cell lysis. And also make sure that you avoid aminoglycosides because they can potentiate the paralytic effects of the toxin at the neuromuscular junction.
Friday morning was a very forgettable conference on a case of the week on this patient that was very fascinating, where there is a diagnostic uncertainty between acute flaccid myelitis versus an early idiopathic transverse myelitis. So I think the big takeaways are, one, just thinking about an approach to weakness, which is already touched on by someone who is much more expert in neurology, but just thinking about, obviously, localization, trying to differentiate upper versus lower motor neuron findings, and then thinking about, is it bilateral, diffuse, focal, sensory versus motor, and the progression. The way that I like to think about it right now that I'm working on is, I'm not a neurologist and ability to localize would be wonderful, but at the very least thinking about disposition and how to escalate care for a patient. So looking for red flags that might go along with weakness, altered mental status, fever, bowel, bladder, respiratory concern, trauma, severe back pain, or signs of increased ICP are things that you can't miss with signs of weakness. Another good takeaway is just neuromuscular weakness and respiratory failure, which is something that we don't see as often, but really thinking about whether it's diaphragmatic versus bulbar. So bulbar, you're thinking about weak cough, poor secretion clearance, or inability to protect airway, which is separate from diaphragmatic weakness, which is what we think of with pure neuromuscular weakness. The forced vital capacity, or FVZ, is a great bedside PFT as it incorporates inspiratory measurements in the form of the negative inspiratory force and expiratory as well, which helps measure your cough and secretion management. Use the patient's clinical status as a guide for intubation and management rather than any bedside PFTs. Don't just anchor on neuromuscular weakness. Patients can aspirate and have other issues. And again, neuromuscular weakness leads to hypoventilation. So any signs of hypoxemia is bad in the sense that it could indicate impending respiratory failure, mucus plug, aspiration, or severe atelectasis. And then ultimately just using time as a diagnostic tool.
All right, now on to one of my favorite parts of the week are tilts. Well, it's actually been a big week for tilts this week. One of the APDs from the internal medicine program at one of our hospitals actually started tilting from his clinical week on service.
Because of Jamie.
Yeah, he did give me a Twitter shout out.
The highest of shout outs.
The highest of shout outs. And then one of our incoming interns announced her match to our program by using the hashtag tilt, which was amazing.
And this is what being on top feels like.
It's good to know that I've left a mark on the program. Anyway, Fish, do you want to go first?
I'll start with my tilts. So my first tilt of the week was about supracondylar fractures, and you'll see exams always say neurovascular intact distally. And what does that actually mean? And it's really important to check because supracondylar fractures carry a high risk of neurovascular injury. So you can use the OK sign. So asking people to make the OK sign with their fingers, test the anterior interosseous nerve, so part of the median nerve, making people give a thumbs up, test the radial nerve, making people open their fingers against resistance, test the ulnar nerve, and then remembering the sensory distributions and checking all of those, and then always checking pulses and cap refill distally from the injury. On a radiology perspective, looking for an anterior posterior fat pad can be an indication, even if the bone doesn't look broken. And then there's some tricks to look at the radiocapitellar alignment and the anterior humeral line to see if they're kind of intersecting through the right place to see if there's any displacement. And then the elbow is just tricky because there's so many ossification centers as kids grow. And so there's a mnemonic called CRITO, which, let's see if I can get this right. It's capitellum, the radial head, the internal epicondyle, the trochlea, the olecranon, and then the external. epicondyle, and it's usually 1, 3, 5, 7, 9, 11 is just a cheap way of remembering when those ossify. And then surgical management is important. So if you see a displaced type 2 or 3 fracture, a displaced flexion type, medial comminution, or neurovascular injury or open fracture, those need to be referred to ortho.
I need you to tell more ortho stuff because I'm really scared for next year because I know such little ortho.
All you have to do is page them and say, bone broke, need help, fix, please. And they'll be there.
My first tilt of the week was about blood culture contamination versus true infections. I had a patient recently that had a blood culture that grew coag negative staph at 24 hours after collection. And the question was whether or not this was a contaminant or a true infection. I think the whole team was, given how well the patient clinically looked, the whole team was leaning towards it being a contaminant. But I did find an interesting study that said that the actual time to positivity can be a really good kind of predictive marker. And this study took a look at a number of kids who had specifically coag negative staph. And it found that for those who had coag negative staph that grew at less than 15 hours from the time of collection, the positive predictive value for a true infection was actually 84%. Whereas if the culture came back positive for the coag negative staph after 24 hours, the positive predictive value for a contaminant was actually 87%. So kind of a big difference in rates of true infection versus contaminant within just a 10-hour time period, which I thought was really, really interesting.
That's super helpful. I think we run into that issue a lot on the floors and thinking about how we likely think something's a contaminant, but we're trying to be conservative, but then it ends up leading to prolonged hospital stays and extra doses of medications that have side effects as well. My next tilt was about something I learned about a QT interval nomogram. So we often get EKGs and look at the QTC, and then that guides a lot of our medical management of patients of what they can and can't receive. And there's been work towards developing a QT interval nomogram, knowing that there's multiple different formulas, and the Bizet formula that we all use tends to be less accurate at the extremes of heart rate, rather bradycardic or tachycardic. But ultimately, the whole point of looking at a QTC is to predict risk of dysrhythmias and torsades. And so there was a QT nomogram that was developed that has been validated in adult poisoned patients where the QTC is super important to look at. And it is now being validated in a pediatric population. And so what it does is it shows heart rate and QT pairs. So you can look at the nomogram, find the patient's heart rate, and then find their QT interval, not the QTC, and plot it along this. And if it's almost like the Tylenol graph, the Rumack-Matthew nomogram, where if they are under it, then they're at lower risk of going into dysrhythmia. But if they're above it, then that's a patient that you need to be really careful of.
Cool. And then my second tilt of the week was about Apgar scoring. So there was a recent study that came out that showed that 10-minute Apgar scoring is actually not as predictive of death and disability as was once thought. So interestingly, the 2015 AHA ILCOR, or the International Liaison Committee on Resuscitation, actually suggested discontinuing resuscitation if the Apgar score at 10 minutes was zero. But then there was actually a change in the recommendations in 2020 that was a little bit more vague and actually no longer had that recommendation. And so this paper that was just published in Pediatrics actually did a retrospective review to take a look at the outcomes of babies who had an Apgar score of zero. Essentially, they found that those with an Apgar score of zero at 10 minutes, out of that group that they studied, first of all, half survived. And then second of all, half of those that survived actually had almost like pretty much no disability at all. And so kind of the bottom line was that, again, the 10 minute Apgar score was actually not as predictive of disability or death as was once thought, which I thought was really interesting and kind of an interesting, like very important change that happened like within the time span of me being a resident. So
my final tilt for this week was actually based on the same case that Dr. Rosen talked about a delayed hemolytic transfusion reaction. And really just thinking about the three pillars of management of what is actually a very life-threatening disease. I think there's a 10% mortality for these patients. And the three pillars are really, pillar one is just stopping hemolysis. And because this is a complement mediated process, your initial measurements are IVIG and steroids, but you can use eculizumab as well as rituximab if you need to transfuse again. But avoiding transfusion is almost a pillar in and of itself. The second pillar is increasing endogenous red blood cell production. So that's done through EPO, IV iron, and then every vitamin that you can think of on the planet, B12, folate, and everything else, just to optimize the bone marrow. And the third pillar is really supportive care in the sense of just optimizing the delivery of oxygen. So this is where some of those formulas that we were forced to learn in medical school actually come in really handy and thinking about what are all of the knobs that we can turn to try to optimize this. So thinking about giving them 100% FiO2 to increase the diffused oxygen measurement in the blood, gut rest, controlling pain, aggressive antipyresis, thinking about respiratory demand, everything that you can do to minimize the metabolic demand on the body.
And then my last tells of the week, I think, is the most important one. If you ever need to get a call room at NotSop Hospital and need to go through the hotel key card system, do not get call room 3. It is the worst call room in the hospital, unless you enjoy sleeping in saunas and waking up in a hot sweat. But if you don't, it's not good. Don't take call room 3.
It's haunted as well.
Well, this has been another episode of BCR Pod. I'm Jamie Lim.
And I'm Michael Fishman. Before we sign off, any upcoming events or things that you want to let our audience know about?
Yeah, so it's still March, which means that it's still Women's History Month. And what I wanted to talk about today was that, so I had my UHAT RAP session last week. And the RAP sessions are research, advocacy, and policy sessions. And as part of it, our group went on a little walking tour of the South End, which was great. And the tour guide focused on African-American history, as well as the abolitionist movement in Boston. And what we found out was that there are actually a lot of places, a lot of like really nondescript places along the South End, like just outside of the BMC area. There are actually really important stops along the Underground Railroad. Also learned a lot about Harriet Tubman on this tour. There is a Harriet Tubman Park in the South End that we also went to, where there are statues that were erected during the 50th anniversary of the Emancipation Proclamation. And then the Harriet Tubman Park is just one of many stops along the Boston Women's Heritage Trail, which is a series of walking tours around Boston that lead past sites important to Boston women's history, including Abigail Adams, Amelia Earhart, Phyllis Wheatley, as well as actually up to 200 famous Boston women.
That's amazing. Thanks so much for sharing that.
We want to thank Chris Justin, our advisor, and our future sponsors. If you're out there, our theme music is Sweet Disposition by The Temper Trap, covered by our own Michael Fishman, and our incidental music is The Four Open Notes of a Ukulele, played by yours truly.
Thanks for joining us, and we hope you'll tune in next week for our next episode of BCR Pod.